Yeah, occasionally you could just.
About how you eat.
Yeah, you could
when you're homeless.
Grab some donuts here or there. A lot of it, you know, I went down and applied for food stamps, and we were getting some assistance there. Didn't have any place to cook anything. Could eat cold beans. If you got it like a small package of sandwich meat, you need to eat it right away, kind of thing. So you kind of eat and go. And that's another thing that I think that some people don't realize when you're dealing with families who are economically challenged, that even though it appears that there are resources there, if there's no place to store the resource wanes. It just kind of, you know, gets gone. We just simply pretty much existed as a result of the graciousness of other people or our individual talents to get to kind of, well, you know how you can kind of go in somewhere and you find somebody who more of a panhandling kind of thing. I wasn't someone who would walk around, hey buddy, would you give me a dime? But I was a little more sophisticated in that I would share with you, you know, how tragic life had been, and people would just hand you $5 or $10, and I would use that money to get what, you know, we need as far as staples go. But pretty much my husband was still working, and he was pulling in what he could, and then saving a portion to get into to a place to live, and that's what we did.
Where'd you
use the bathroom? Outdoor, outdoor bathrooms. Krispy Kreme actually had two outdoor bathrooms, so it was real convenient. There was two gas stations in the area that also had outdoor bathrooms, and it was during the time, you know, now we've got a customer-only kind of thing, but back then, you know, if you pulled up and wanted to use the bathroom somewhere, it wasn't a real big issue. We tried to be careful not to be seen going in and out too often. And that was, I guess I didn't think that anybody would lock me out of the bathroom, but I just didn't like the looks of, oh my gosh. And I was certainly concerned that someone might feel that they needed to be a parent to my child better than myself. And we kind of try to be careful about not being identified.
Showers?
That was also done in the outdoor bathrooms. And it's amazing, especially if you have long hair, how difficult it can be. Your hair goes down the drain in the sink, and it's kind of hard to kind of capture it all out, and then try to make sure everything's cleaned up before you leave, because, you know, if they know that that's what you're doing in there, they certainly are not going to allow you in the bathroom. We had some friends who had, you know, housing or apartments, and occasionally we would pop over there and take what we call a real shower, you know, and even cook a real meal kind of thing. But for the most part, we were pretty much on our own. We had a lot of people live with us, but it seemed like when we needed a place to live, it wasn't going to work out for us to be there. So we learned a lot about that too, about who your friends are and who your acquaintances are, and kind of came to the shocking reality that we didn't have a lot of friends, and but that was okay.
What about how'd you get the idea of hanging out at the drive-in?
Well, the house that we lived in was right next door to the drive-in, and it just made sense. Well, nobody was utilizing it during the day, and you know, we just go on over there and hang out. We had to be somewhere, and we had to be somewhere where we weren't stuck in the car all day. And I'm talking about my daughter and myself, because, you know, my husband was at work most of the time, and because it gets hot in the car.
And what time of year was it?
This was in the summer, spring, summer, which the summers weren't as hot as they are now. I do think that there's something to this global warming thing going down, but it was warm. And this particular drive-in had like a little play area for the kids, and the way the drive-in sat up, the sun was behind it, so we had this huge shaded area. And it was really kind of, we actually had some fun there, you know. My daughter, again, seriously thought she had the greatest play yard, and the, you know, with the merry-go-round and little bouncy horses and the swing set and those kinds of things.
Were y'all completely on your own? Did you encounter other homeless people much?
No. Homelessness was a whole lot different then than it is now. I mean, not that homelessness is the same, but the amount of people.
Well, can you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah.
Both of your experience, you know, personally, well, and kind of professionally. I mean, that's one of the biggest changes that I've seen in my lifetime. I don't remember.
You may have seen a person
right
around a barrel, and I'm not sure that they were actually homeless. They just may have been not able to get home.
Even then, it was like maybe somebody passing through.
Yeah, it just wasn't something that you saw a lot of. I don't recall ever seeing a homeless family. One big reason is that the likelihood of keeping your family intact there's a lot more understanding today that homelessness may just be a transitioning period that you're in. It doesn't necessarily mean that you're morally not capable of being a parent.
Right.
But the fear of having DSS or somebody become involved and kind of, I didn't ask them for help in trying to get a house or anything because I was scared that they may come get my child. They don't have a policy that said that,
right,
but I mean, that was a fear that I had.
Sure.
And that's a fear that families still have that we work with, but it's not as intense. And certainly after we assure them that, you know, you are providing shelter once you're here.
So can you talk a little bit about kind of the increase in homelessness?
Well, the biggest...
What's that about?
Well, I think during Reagan's administration, there was an endeavor by the ACLU that looked at mental illness, people who were confined in institutions. Some people, like there was a gentleman in North Carolina who was actually confined as a child, and his only problem was that he was actually deaf.
I remember that.
And
Goldsboro.
Right. And you know, now he's been in that institution so long that, you know, he doesn't want to live anywhere else. I mean, that's his life. So the ACLU wanted to kind of act on behalf of people who were being kind of imprisoned in an institutional setting, and that if you suffer from mental illness or whatever, you have to be confirmed unable to conduct yourself. Can you hold just a second? But What they succeeded in doing was that you could not be kept in an institution or group home, which this really impacted the group homes, if you had any competency.
Uh-huh.
And so what they did is in a day, they pretty much shut down all the in-betweens, an institution and the street, places where people could go. That were trying to learn different ways of life, recovering addicts, recovering alcoholics, borderline mental illness disorders. People with depression flood our streets.
Wow.
And these are functional people.
Right.
But they have no place to go for help because by the time you have that kind of a problem, you probably don't have insurance. That means that nobody's going to touch it with a 10-foot pole except for an overburdened mental health system through the county that we have here that does good work. They do great work here, but they are just way overwhelmed. So these places where people could be, residential type settings, were no longer there. That immediately impacted what we see on our streets. We see a lot of people who are schizophrenic, who upon being medicated are fine. The moment that they're medicated and fine, they're functional. They cannot remain in an institutional setting.
Right.
So they're put out. Well, the reason that they need that kind of support is kind of like with depression. When you're on medication, you feel okay.
So you don't take medication.
So why bother? And the sad thing with schizophrenia is you digress into a situation where you wouldn't even know sometimes that you had medication you needed to take. Alzheimer's patients. We have three women that are wandering around our streets now. They're obviously suffering from Alzheimer's disease. These are women whose families live in this community, and I suspect somebody's cashing their Social Security checks.
So these are fairly old people.
Mm-hmm. But they don't meet criteria to fit in anywhere, and they can't be kept anywhere because their Alzheimer's hasn't put them to the, they have these periods of lucidness that's when they'd have to be let loose. And I think that's where we began seeing a lot of people on the street. Then we began this flux of retail development. I have very little respect for retail development. I kind of figure these are the biggest rapers of our communities. We have corporations and companies that come set shop up here, and they employ people in retail environment, which consists of you don't get a guaranteed. We have a law that mandates what they must pay you. It's called minimum wage. They don't give you any kind of benefits. Their objective is to work you the most for the least amount of hours. There's very little room at the top, and very little likelihood that you're going to have any retirement in that company. And you have no grievance committees or you know, it's kind of like where you work. They cannot just come and fire you. There's a process. Well, you know, McDonald's can come and just fire you. And there's 45 other people standing in line to work there.
And people like that, you see people like that on the street.
Oh, yes, because they can't afford to live here, because the retail environment takes its profits and carries it back to its corporate. It doesn't reinvest in the community. So we've got this retail community that's developing that attracts people with money. So we have a lot of retirees and people that have resource coming here. You can drive around Fayetteville. All the new development is $100,000 or better. That's way beyond my means, and it's certainly beyond the means of the families that work that are here in our program. And there's kind of a closing out of the older homes that they could have been rented at least reasonably. So there's a tremendous lack of affordable housing. So we've got another group of people that are working people that can't afford to live here. And so they rob Peter to pay Paul, and eventually the child gets the chicken pox for 3 days, is out of daycare, mom doesn't get to work, and she's homeless as a result of a 3-day not able to go to work. And nobody cares, because we have a workforce system that works well. But we have a workforce system that really needs to look at if retail employment is the objective, we're selling the people short. And if public housing is considered permanent housing, we're selling people short. I don't think that I want to spend my life in public housing. I'd like to have some control over my destiny. And I say, why not help people to become community builders? If we can work with people and give them the opportunity, the time, all we need is a little time, the time that I needed to get a degree, you know, the time that someone else may need to get an associate's, the time that someone gets a trade, to increase their earning potential. It allows them to be potential home buyers, which increases the market here. And also increase the tax base. These people wind up putting money into community. I don't understand why we don't want to teach people how to be investors. Why do we want to keep them borderline hanging off the edge of a cliff? I don't understand it. But the population is definitely increasing. We've been staying pretty much at full capacity for 2 years.
What does that mean?
That means that we have a waiting list of sometimes up to 20 families to get into this program. And that's 20 families too many.
Is there any numbers at all about the numbers of homeless people in Fayetteville?
We've kind of tossed around some numbers. At any given time, I think that the last continuum of care that was submitted had about 1,500 at any given time in Cumberland County could be homeless. I think that that's probably fairly accurate. That would include the street people and homeless people, and there is a difference. Doesn't mean that street people aren't homeless. People are people that still have the desire to find a home. Street people are people who have consoled themselves to, this is where I'm going to live. kind of like I was talking about, that mesmerization that occurs. Why bother trying to do this housing thing, you know? Also, if you happen to have depression or schizophrenia, or you may not even be aware of where it is you are living, we have people here that are surviving day to day. They're so busy trying to get that meal, trying to find a place to park the buggy, trying to get a change of clothes and dip in a creek somewhere to get clean, that there just isn't really a whole lot of room for anything else in the day. Homeless people are destined to become street people if we don't intervene. And even street people have rights to shelter. And
does the, being in Fayetteville, is there a distinctive character to the homeless population? Does the, that would make Fayetteville different than Raleigh? Or one of the things that came to mind right away was the military. Is there any connection?
Well, I think that we wind up having families, more families here maybe than in other areas, because people get out of the military and they stay in Fayetteville, and often their extended families are in other states. So if they experience a lack of employment or something, they don't have immediate family nearby to help, so they're more at risk to becoming homeless. We also have men who wind up with drug situations. They get out of the military or disappear, and immediately a family, a mom, we just worked with a mom who had expected to be a military wife and mother for the next 20 years of her life, all of a sudden without a place to live and no husband, and in a shelter, and all her family lived in Alaska, whom she had not seen in 9 years. And we were able to kind of coordinate the efforts between Department of Social Services, a board member here, and some local funds, and we got her and her children sent to Alaska, because that's where she needed to be. She needed to be with her family. So I think the military does have an impact. I think we get people that get disgruntled with the military and ETS quickly, and find that working at Hardee's is not as grand as working in the Army, and they'll fire you, which is a little different. So, I mean, we do get a little bit of that, but I think that the military does impact us in the number of families that we serve. Also, the transient nature of the community. Our entire community shifts because people come and they stay for a certain amount of time and they're gone, so we lose the sense of community within community sometimes. So when a neighbor is struggling, we may not be as connected neighborly, and I think that oftentimes impacts homelessness. But that may not be just relative to military communities. I'm hearing that kind of thing happens in, you know, other urban areas. It just may be the development of city life. We're kind of in a transition between the rural and the urban, Fayetteville is. We're not quite either or. But the mental illness, I think that we tend to have more than our fair share of people that are struggling with mental illness on the street. And a lot of that has to do with the fact that we're on 95. And quite frankly, there are people that literally put people on buses and they give them ticket money and they tend to arrive in Fayetteville. Well, you get various prison systems, various institutions. I don't know that Dorothy Dix actually puts people on buses, but I know that people arrive here that have been recently there. I don't know who paid their way, but they did get there. And we probably have, in comparison to Raleigh and Charlotte and the larger cities, we probably have less resources in working with these people, and the stigma that our community has embraced, that we have been fighting here. I know I've been fighting for 4 years actively, that people want to be homeless. They're just a bunch of bums. They're a bunch of drunks. They're a bunch of drug addicts. They're this, they're that. And I'm like, even so, they're not going away. And so what are we going to do to make a difference? And if we make a difference in one person, look at the value of that. The value of that. I mean, I contribute. Yeah, I contribute. And I'm not unique. One thing I have learned, just as much as I was just a garden variety alcoholic, drunk, I'm just as much a garden variety human being with no special talents and no special preferences or no special anything. I'm just like everybody else. And so... Well, I do. But I think that I sincerely believe that if I could do this, there are other people that can do this out there. And I'm working. We've worked with a lady who has done this herself, and her name is Mary. And I'm so proud of her. She came to us 2 years ago, and she was a situation. She wasn't a drunk. She wasn't an alcoholic. She lived with a drunk and tried to keep a family together for 10 years, and he decided he wanted a family somewhere else. And he did that. And she arrived to us totally devastated, having been betrayed and dumped all in a day with two kids and nowhere to go, no resources. And in 2 short years, she has just been given the opportunity to be in Habitat House. She's almost completed all of her sweat equity hours. She's pulled two other families in, one that she took care of in her own home while she was struggling. We didn't have space. I called her up. I said, Mary, I hate to ask you, but do you have room? You know, I've kind of screened them. I don't think they're going to rob you blind. Can't make any guarantees, but they need a place to stay. She opened her home, and one of those families that she's worked with is on their way to looking at becoming a Habitat homeowner. You know, so, I mean, I don't think that, I think the stigma is so easy to grab onto, because then we can walk away. We don't have to take ownership of what's our part in Cumberland County or in the state of North Carolina that allows these conditions to keep on going, that allows someone suffering from schizophrenia to wander the streets, you know, from a legislation that certainly wasn't intended for that. But it just makes it convenient for the insurance companies, and then the state doesn't bear any tax burden to allow them to continue wandering around. And then we can wander around paying a little less tax and say, well, isn't that ugly? Because we don't want to accept responsibility. Where when we see that $100,000, $200,000 homes are being built, and we know darn well that only a small portion in our community can afford those, why don't we demand that reasonable housing be developed? You know, why don't we demand that city property that is owned and is just run down be available for renovation so that people can have homes? Why don't we demand these things? You know, is it because we're afraid we're going to lose our jobs? I happen to be in a job where it is my job to demand these things, so I'm grateful for that. But I get real frustrated when I sit around and I'm with people who, well, I'm so glad you're here because you can say this. I'm like, you're here. Why can't you say this? Well, you know, that might negatively impact my job, or it may not be politically correct. And I think that at some point in time, we've got to look at what's morally correct, what's right. When you walk by and you see children, we don't have to feed the children overseas. We've got people right here that they may not necessarily be starving for food, but they're starving for life and freedom and respect and hope and dreams. On our questionnaire, one of the things that we ask is, when you were a little girl or when you were a child, and it was real neat that you asked that question, what did you dream of being? Because what I find is 9 times out of 10 people who have suffered and went through systems and institutional support have been stripped of hope and dreams. They're not even there. And let's get back to that. What is your dream? What was your dream? And where is it now? And how can we get there? How can we get back to that?
You seem to have both now. I mean, the hope and the dream.
Yeah.
Again.
I do. I mean, and that gives me life.
Yeah.
It gives me life.
What are some of those? You said you had dreams.
Dreams. Well, one dream is to get this project finished.
That's
a good project. People kind of laughed at it when I brought people out here and I said, this is what I see. And people are like, okay, you know. and now it's real neat to see those people being some of the biggest supporters. I think personal dreams, I have this dream of sitting on a porch overlooking the mountain and writing about the things that I've experienced and writing about the people that I've met and just leaving that for somebody. Because I think sometimes we hear about the people who live these lives that just aren't the norm. But I think that most of us struggle day to day with just basic things like, how do I accept love, and how do I be a friend, and how do I understand betrayal, and how do I get past these things, just simple things. How do I forgive, and how do I go on, and how do I become? Those are the things that as I discover them, I'd like to be able to put them down somewhere. My real big dream, though, before that happens, because that's 80 years old on the porch, is to at some point in time get my doctorate and go back to Fayetteville State and teach. That would be like the greatest honor and privilege I could ever think of, is standing with the people who stood with me and sharing a little bit of theory and speculation and life experience. In such a progressive and open institution, that's kind of like my big one.
That's a noble one too.
I would like to do that. I wouldn't even really care if they paid me. I'd just like to be able to share like things were shared with me. And I think there's a difference between teaching and sharing. And I think that they're both components that a scholar has to have. You got to get something past the book, and you've got to pull it from you, and you've got to put it in there. And it's so neat to watch a spark come up in somebody, you know, to see. 'Cause I really didn't even know what I wanted to be, and I watched a spark come up in myself, and I still don't know what it is I want to be. I know I want to be sober. And I want to be of use. I have a very intense need to be useful. But as far as being something, I don't know what that is yet. But sitting in, you know, you've got 2 years of core curriculum that you can spend your time doing, investigating things. But I remember being in a theory class and immediately knowing right then and there exactly what I wanted to be. I wanted to be someone who studied people. And group interactions, and the interactions of individuals and groups, and just how we all move, because it's always fascinated me, because it was something I could never get a hold of.
Right.
And now I'm kind of getting a little bit of a hold of it, in that I'm comfortable with myself, so that's the whole key, pretty much, to all of it. I can be uncomfortable in a group and still not be uncomfortable with me. And that's kind of like, if we can walk away from any educational experience and have that. Dr. Jun, he went back to Korea, he was like the most profound. He's a graduate from Harvard. I kept wondering, why in the world is he teaching at Fayetteville State? And he said he expected Harvard, you know, respectability, and he expected that kind of caliber out of his students. And he worked us like dogs. And he called me out of class one day, and he sat in his office, and he said, "Do you know what the whole point of learning here at a university is? Do you know?" And I said, "Well, yeah, you know, you experience this, you kind of become well-rounded, a little bit of the arts, a little bit of humanity." Right. You know. He was like, "No," he said, "chuck that." He said, "It's all about discipline." And he taught me about the word discipline, because that had always been a word I didn't like. And he taught me that discipline was developing stick-to-itiveness, which was another word I'd never heard of. What in the world does that mean? And it's all about just finishing what you start. So, you know, if I could just pass that on to somebody, I think I'd be doing pretty good, you know, because you look at how many people start and they don't finish. I've started thousands of times in my life. I started to stop drinking every day for years, and hopefully I'm finished now.
I think that's a good place to end, except is there anything, well, just two quick things. Since you began here, are there particular people, street people or homeless people, that have particularly struck you or impressed you in a way that has touched you, or that you think people should know about?
I think in the eyes of pretty much everyone who comes through our doors, I think that's what impresses me most. When they come in and they cannot even, during the initial interview, lift their eyes from the carpet. And then just after just a couple of days, how they come in with a smile and they sit down and they're comfortable and their body language is relaxed. I think that's what impresses me most, because what reason do they have to trust us? What reason do they have? We're just another institution, part of another bigger wheel turning. The innocence in that, as far as particular families go, I think the thing that probably grips me most is the children in each family. Children who don't understand how their whole life changed in a day. Everything that they owned is gone. They're being drugged from place to place. People are looking at them, making judgments. They hear comments about their family member, their mother or their father. They see it on TV and in the paper. And to watch these children trying to maintain their self-respect through all that, I think that if any time that you get to where you wonder why in the world should you go on, you should come here and visit one of these children, because they give me every reason every day to continue doing what I do and to be grateful, truly grateful, for what we have. You have to be grateful for what you have at some point, instead of always looking at what you don't have. And I've had little kids come in and say simply, we've got a meal, we've got a bed, we've got people who care about us. We're happy. And I'm like, they don't have a home, they don't have a backyard. They're being ridiculed at school. They've already been labeled. And many have been labeled with multiple labels. Because they're acting out sometimes under the stress, gets misinterpreted. So they're having to function under all these challenges, and yet they come in after school and they come running up with pictures that they drew and give us hugs and give us, they feed us. They come in ready with gifts. And I think that's the most outstanding thing that I've ever seen. I know people who go to work every day that give a whole lot less.
Yeah. Do you get a seems like someone living through what you lived through and being exposed to like that now and those children, you could get pretty jaded pretty easily about the prospects of society and how it cares for its own.
When I kind of look, it's kind of a two-sided coin. On some days I'm absolutely disgusted how we could just allow this to continue on a day-to-day basis here and walk away, just walk away. People walk by it. It's happening here in Fayetteville. You could be half dead on the street, you know, and somebody just like walk by you like you're oblivious, you're not there. But then on the other side, I remember the people who stopped, that stopped for me. And what I have to make sure is I stop and that I tell other people to stop. Each of us, if each of us just stops, it makes a difference. And whatever it is our passion is, you know, I have a variety of passions. I was trying to fix the hole in the ozone layer, but it didn't work out.
Maybe there's still time.
So I don't buy spray products, and I do what I do here.
I think that's a good place to stop, except is there anything that you think I should ask that I didn't?
No, I can't think of anything at all.
Well, thank you very much.
Thank you.